Thank you for thank you for doing this with me.
You're very welcome.
Very cool. Happy July 4th, even though you're not an American.
And well, happy July 4th to you. Yes, I'm not American. I'm not British either. But I still have great misgivings about the legality of overthrowing legitimate government, or calling George III a tyrant. He's about the kindliest man that ever sat on the throne. But never mind. So enjoy your freedom.
Thank you. So here's actually, I've had many discussions with friends. This is something that I think only Lutherans think about. That I mean, that I've noticed with the various people I've spoken with. So everybody else considers it like totally legitimate. You did the right thing, whatever. But they're of course all speaking from a post-revolutionary, we won, I'm an American context, right? Yeah. But amongst my Lutheran friends, the discussion I've noticed has always been, yeah, we probably shouldn't have done that, but we're here now. So, you know, like you know, it's done now, but you know, at the time, was it the thing to do?
You know, I'm quite a make America Great Britain Again kind of guy.
and Britain is known for being just so sunny and cheerful all the time,
full of optimism and beautiful weather. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. Where are you from originally?
Finland.
Finland.
Yes.
How is it there?
Less warm, about as sunny as Britain. Finland's about the same latitude as Alaska.
Oh, wow.
But enjoys the benefits of the Gulf Stream. So it's got a temperate climate. You know, it's probably about the size of, I'm just doing this from the top of my head now, but I'm guessing if you stick Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin together, that gives you Finland in terms of its size. So it's got a lot of Finns went to the Otus, and that's for a reason. One reason was they were late to the game, and the other one was that it's similar climate. And Canada, you think of Canada, southern Canada in winter, and maybe a bit further north in the summer. It doesn't get very hot.
Okay, that actually sounds really nice. I'm a cold weather guy.
Yeah, I mean the weather's fine. It's the trouble with living very far north is that you really run out of daylight in the winter. It's very short days. And of course, about a third of the country is north of the Arctic Circle, and the sun just doesn't rise.
That's wild.
Or set in the summer, which is equally crazy.
Like it's just up. It's just.
It rises in May and sets in late or July.
So it's just it's just straight daytime.
Yeah, sun just goes around the sky in a big circle for a couple of months straight. But then in the winter it sets in November and rises again in January.
So, how do you deal with that? Like psychologically, I would go insane.
Well, I've never lived up there. It's in the far north. Not very many people do.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
About quarter of a million people. But the answer, short answer is these days, is alcohol. There's a lot of problems. I mean, these days you've got electric lighting and all kinds of things like that.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Anyway, that's where I'm from. So.
Cool. How'd you get to England?
It's a bit of a long story. So when I was in my mid-teens, my parents went out to Kenya as missionaries in the Lutheran Church just for a year, as it was supposed to be. They stayed for 20, and I stayed for 5, and ended up finishing my schooling there. And so essentially followed a British school curriculum there, returned to Finland to do national service, which is compulsory for all men. In fact, my son just started his national service 3 hours ago. Then went back to Kenya for a year just to work. And while I was there, just literally on a whim, following a brief conversation with my parents one evening, was just sitting drinking tea, and I rang up my old school and put in an application to university in England just to see what happens. Got accepted, came here, and then just before I graduated, made the classic mistake of falling for an English girl, and stayed here ever since.
Yep.
So that was in 1995. So I've been here quite a while.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah,
that's amazing. So, your son has dual citizenship, I'm guessing, then?
Yeah, well, my children do. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. How do you feel? How do you feel about mandatory conscription? Is it just men, or is it women now too?
It's men. Men have to. Women can apply to volunteer. And in fact, my son volunteered because he's a dual citizen living abroad. He didn't have to, so he volunteered. But if you are a nation with a population roughly that of Los Angeles, mm-hmm. with a 800-mile land border with Russia, most people are in favor of military service.
I'm in favor of it as well. I mean, maybe over here, maybe mandatory everyone going into the U.S. Army isn't going to work. But perhaps your state's National Guard or something. I'm always in favor of that because, I don't know. I feel like it gives you some kind of a common culture or like identity with people that you otherwise, you know, it's the thing church does. I heard once that church is people that you otherwise wouldn't interact with that you're now forced to be a family with, right? And I think that's necessary for nations and communities and people to have
need bonds, things that, you know, common culture and I mean countries like the state, in a way. I was having little lighthearted banter with an American friend this morning who's complaining about the fact that all the best food in Britain is imported. And I pointed out to him that everything in America is imported. There's nothing, or virtually. But, you know, when you have a sort of melting pot kind of country, you do need common institutions, common cultural references. Yep. I mean, the Northern European countries like Finland have been, until the last 10 years at least, incredibly homogenous. Mm-hmm. You know, ethnically and even genetically and culturally. And it's been one of the things that enable them to survive amongst the empires.
Yeah. I mean, really, it's important to have that, to have like a connection, right? Because it comes back to like trust, you know, you can't develop a high trust kind of society where, you know, you can depend on the stranger on the bus if something happens. You can't do that without some kind of a common cultural.
Yeah, I think there's a Finnish politician who was around the kind of time when your country was being torn apart by the debate about Obamacare, mm-hmm. and people are in a lot of comparisons with the Scandinavian or Nordic countries, Finland, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, there's a Finnish political scientist, I think, teaches one of the East Coast universities. Just pointed out that there's a complete different culture, for example, about taxation. Mm-hmm. So he said in the American attitude to taxes, I pay taxes to buy things for others. And in Nordic attitude to taxes, I pay taxes so that we all get services.
Right.
You know, there's a completely different mindset. But of course, that works in a small country. I mean, if Finland was in North America, it would be a state of the USA. I mean, it's
right.
small
so,
enough for that.
And that's
it's a completely different. You can't compare. You know, it's orange. Apples and oranges.
And I try and point that out to people. I'll have friends that'll say, oh, well, we need, you know, they do universal healthcare over in this country, and I'm like, yeah, that country with 3 million people, we have 400 million people in the United States. Like, you can't the mismanagement of that would be staggering. And I mean, you can look at any federal program over here and get that. But state by state, I'm totally in favor. If North Carolina wanted to set up a state healthcare system where everybody just got good healthcare, I mean, yeah, let's go. I'm down.
Yeah, yeah.
I've tried to...
America is an empire. Mm-hmm. That's what people need to understand. America is a land empire.
Yeah.
And it's not a nation. It's not a nation state.
Right.
And it can never be.
And it was set up with the idea that states would be largely independent and self-governing. And like the framers of the Constitution were worried enough about the individual states that they included in the thing that, hey, look, if someone has rights in one state or they're treated as a citizen in Indiana, you can't not treat them like a citizen in Maine. You know, like that's in there because they were worried enough that something like that could happen, that South Carolina would just all of a sudden say, look, we don't believe you're a U.S. citizen if you're from North Dakota or whatever, you know. And
yeah. Even though it might be fair enough.
Yeah. They had to guard against that. So I don't know. Mm. I don't know. I don't like politics. Let me ask you a question. I want to get a non-American opinion on this. Over here, people use this idea of like two kingdoms, you know, like church and civil government. And these are like the two realms or whatever. And they use this sort of idea and this sort of theology to make mandatory like maximum political participation. Because, it's your vocation as an American, so you have to vote in every election and do all this. And I don't know. It feels like a very American thing to me, because there are like a lot of Lutheran churches that are like also state churches, like in Scandinavian countries. So what's your feeling about that?
I mean, two kingdom theology is biblical, obviously. I mean, you know, there is, you know, the classic passages from Romans 13 about where the governing authorities are God's servants, but not in a spiritual sense, but simply for the maintenance of order and so on. And so, you know, for example, you know, whenever I teach catechism to adults, and we get to the eighth commandment, the seventh commandment, and about the prohibition against stealing, said, you know, that means you pay your taxes and you don't try to, you don't pay your workmen in cash to avoid paying taxes. You know, this is what it means. You know, taxes owed some money, pay your taxes. It's in the Bible. But of course, my late father, who's a considerably greater theologian than I am, he had a visceral hatred, I think, of what he calls a theology by slogans, of which all traditions are guilty, and they have just different slogans. So we do law and gospel, two kingdoms, means of grace, word and sacrament, and they become these sort of autonomous kind of things that just meld around, and then they become wax noses out of which we build all kinds of things. And of course, the two kingdoms theology is called two kingdoms. if you said to Martin Luther, we're going to have a country now, and we're going to have a system of government where every citizen, every person who lives in the country gets to take part in the decisions, he will probably say something quite colorful back about as to how wise that is. So that particular distinctive was like worked out within the setting of a very non-democratic system of government.
Right.
And it's just assumed that you have a hierarchy, an explicit hierarchy. I mean, I can't think of a more aristocratic and hierarchical political realm than the United States of America in real life, but at least on paper it's not.
Right.
You know, you have probably the richest politicians in the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, very, very, very elite. But at the same time, so how does that work out in practice, therefore? Well, if you have a democracy, I do believe that it's really important to participate in it, because if for no other reasons, it's like, you know, the classic difference between American customers in a restaurant and British customers in a restaurant. If the food's not good, the Americans will complain to the waiter. If the food's not good, the British will complain to each other. You know, this is grumbling, and so if you're not participating, then obviously you don't have a right. If you didn't vote, you stepped outside the system, and you just become an observer. Whether I would go so far as is your vocation, in the sense that if you don't vote, you are sinning. That's another matter.
Mm-hmm.
It's not commanded in scripture in that very specific way.
Right.
And of course, there are many ways of participating in the common life other than voting in elections. I mean, one reason, I'm not a British citizen, although I've lived my entire adult life. I've been here for more than a quarter of a century now. I'm still not a citizen. And one reason is it's horrendously expensive to take up citizenship. And I've always got better use for my money than that.
Right.
And the other one is that I'm quite pleased not to get to vote in local elections or in national elections because the choice is so poor.
Right.
But if I was, I would be very tempted to vote for Donald Duck. You spoil my vote. But by spoiling your vote, you're participating.
At least.
Without taking sides.
Yeah.
So, basically you say none of the above. And to be able to say none of the above is actually part of the democratic process as well. But I'd be very careful about calling that anything more than Christian wisdom as opposed to Christian obligation.
Yeah. Because I don't like voting in national elections. I'm okay with some local politics there. Sometimes they're my city council, my mayor, even some state elections. But like national elections, we currently have a system where it costs about $2 billion to become the president, which is dumb. And, I don't know. So I get a lot of heat for that because I don't know. It's a reality TV show. It's not actually, a thing on the national level. It's a circus and I don't really enjoy it. And I catch a lot of heat for that because people tell me, it is your vocation and you have to vote. And they have this big thing where they'll talk about two kingdoms theology and they use that as a sort of bludgeon to ensure that you're maximally participative in politics. And I don't really jive with that.
I think Christians ought to, Christians being involved in politics is a really, really important thing.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't go kind of all Puritan and talk about Christian magistrates as a kind of an outward, kind of extension of the kingdom of God necessarily, like some of my friends here do, but that Christians participate in the common life is really, really important.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, we are, as Jesus says, you are the light of the world. We're a city on a hill. We're the salt of the earth. And so if we don't, we thereby leave it to everybody else.
Right.
And how's that going?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Poorly.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't discourage anyone from participating to the maximum that they feel useful, but yeah, I don't know. I'm getting some kind of low storage warning, but we'll see how it goes. We will see how it goes. So, how is it being a Lutheran pastor in the UK?
I love it. I used to do something else before. I used to be a teacher, and I haven't woken up once since then thinking, maybe I should go back. But, I assume that most of the people who listen to your podcast are based in North America, and I think one thing that it's very, very important for them to understand is that Lutheranism in this country is absolutely minute on the ground. You take any national or even regional population statistic, and we fit comfortably within the margin of error several times
over. Wow.
Right. So there are the population of this country is somewhere knocking around about 65 million. And if you ignore the kind of statistical hokery pokery that churches are sometimes guilty of in trying to look like they're bigger than they are, there are, I'm guessing, fewer than 2,000 Lutherans.
Wow.
And so I serve the Evangelical Lutheran Church of England, which started life as first as a mission of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and then quite amusingly, the two original London congregations were for half a century part of the Atlantic District of the Missouri Synod. So the Atlantic District really was Atlantic. It crossed all the way over to London. And since 1954, it's been an independent church. We are you know, Sister Church of the Missouri Synod and in Church Fellowship with Missouri Synod, we have in this whole church 14 congregations.
Wow. Wow.
14 congregations, all of which are, by kind of your kind of standards, are minute, really small. So I'm guessing that there isn't a single Lutheran church at the moment within our church body that averages anywhere near 50 on a Sunday.
Oh, wow.
So maybe, you know, 40 maybe, might be there, 40, 45, so the bigger ones, and then the smaller ones are in single figures. And wow. So not all of them have pastors as a result. We do have a theological college or seminary in Cambridge called Westfield House. I was trained there, and it trains pastors from time to time, but it also has other study programs. So quite a few students of the Concordia universities, and as well as Valparaiso University and a couple of other places, send their students there for sort of study programs, and you know, so it's very valuable to, you know, but being based in Cambridge is quite attractive to people to come and spend some time there. But it's, I mean, we are a very small church, and wherever we are the small church in town.
Right.
So, you know, I live in a town of about 100,000 people, and our Sunday attendance is low 20s on average. Hmm. And there are, of those 100,000 people, there must be tens of thousands who don't know that we exist.
Right.
Because we didn't have a building of our own anymore. That got, you know, we lost that before my time, 20 years ago now. And so, yeah, that's the kind of, on one hand, that's the big challenge.
Yeah.
Because obviously not many people, not much money, not much of anything at all. On the other hand, being a small church is a fantastic blessing in many ways. One is that everybody knows everybody, which is a good thing on the whole. It means that we are uniform. So, you know, we all... Yeah, so I was saying that one of the great things is that uniformity, that, you know, our churches, you know, we have differences, regional and local differences, but you go to every church, any church in our within the ELC, and everybody is using the Lutheran service book from the hymnal.
Right.
And, you know, we have, you know, some guys are, you know, temperamentally more liturgical than others and so on, but we are all liturgical.
Right.
We all vest. Most churches have weekly communion, and those who don't have it most weeks.
Yeah.
And so that's that, and that sort of thing. And so when the pastors of the church get together, every pastor's in the room. It's a very small room, but right. There we're all in the same place. We talk to each other all the time. And a lot of the laity across congregations know each other as well.
Yeah.
Being a pastor of a small local congregation is something I would never want. I put it this way, I wouldn't want to do anything else. If you offered me a call to, you know, I don't know, 500 member church, I'd probably turn it down just because it's too big.
Yeah.
Because my church is so small that if somebody walks into church whom I don't recognize, I know that they're not part of my congregation.
Right.
If somebody's not there, I can tell without having to check my membership list. And that, in terms of pastoral care and forming a Christian community, that's really, really important.
Yeah.
But of course, the nearest Lutheran congregation to ours, I'm in a place called Fareham, which is right next to the city of Portsmouth, which people may have heard of,
right where that is.
Right, bang in the centre of the south coast of England, opposite the Isle of Wight. You know, this is where we are. Our next nearest Lutheran congregation is 85 miles away in West London.
Wow.
So we don't have any real kind of week to week or even month to month fellowship with local churches. If you're a member of the Lutheran church here, this is it.
Right.
This is your universe. And there is no, and if you don't like coming to our church and you want to go to a Lutheran church, it's going to be a long drive. Mm. And quite a few of our members do come a long way. And we have members who travel an hour to get to church every Sunday. Some of them don't even own cars necessarily. And it's a challenge.
Yeah.
It's a real challenge when people live. I mean, if you take the furthest at one end or the furthest to the other end of my kind of the reach of our congregation, and you could travel an hour and a half from get to the kind of people who live furthest away in the west to people who live furthest away in the east, which means that they never see each other except in church.
Right.
And some of them live so far that they can only make it on Sunday mornings, and if we put anything else on, they're not there. because they can't be. And it's right. those sorts of things which make it very difficult in some ways to create kind of really solid solid community, and one that then has, if you like, tentacles into the community beyond the church.
Right.
You know, if you get on the 8:30 train on a Sunday morning to come to church at 10:30, it's quite difficult to invite your friends to come with you.
Right.
Yeah, as opposed to walking across the road.
I'm in the AALC, which is Altar and Pulpit Fellowship with the LCMS.
I know,
and I guess like per capita, we're in the same boat. Our numbers are a little bigger. We have more congregations than that, and more members, but I would say the average Sunday attendance of our congregations is probably between 30 and 50, just as a rule. We have a couple of churches that have, you know, 200-300 members, and like they're the big like rock star churches. And then we have a couple of churches that have, you know, 8-9 members. My church, we get between 40 and 60 people kind of in general. That drops significantly over the summer. Everybody's traveling and going on vacation and whatnot.
Whereabouts are you? Whereabouts are you?
North Carolina. I'm about an hour from the East Coast.
Okay. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. I'm in Fayetteville, North Carolina, Fort Bragg, largest army installation in the U.S., I think.
Yeah, I think I know. I've heard about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's honestly, that keeps our church going. We have every kind of Lutheran here. It's pretty wild just because of the military moving people in and out. We have a big ELCA church. We have a big Wells congregation. We have an LCMS church. Our church is AALC. And then there's like half a dozen little, like micro synod, you know, 3-person, you know, churches in the area as well that are Lutheran after a fashion, I suppose. I want to ask, since you mentioned that your church was initially a plant by the LCMS and y'all are in fellowship with the LCMS, that puts you in the conservative Lutheran column.
Yeah.
On issues, on gender identity issues, gay marriage, things like that, I'm going to guess. Is that, how is that in Europe? How is that? I know in Canada that's a bit tricky. They have laws about pronoun use and whatnot. How is it in Europe? Is it difficult?
Nobody else is great. Yes, in some ways. In this country, we are quite blessed, as it happens, that we've got enough people pushing against it. And obviously, very famously, J.K. Rowling of Harry Potter famous has kind of got herself into theoretically hot water. I mean, she's big and rich enough that she can ride it reasonably easy, right. I imagine. But you know, there is a very loud, small but loud and vocal sort of resistance. That's prominent enough so that it can't just slide sort of unnoticed under the door. And so much so that because we have obviously got the BBC, which is national radio, a couple of our political parties, prominent political parties, have been very, woolly on definitions of what makes a man or a woman, and it's not uncommon for politicians at certain times being asked on the BBC, on live television, live radio, what is a woman? Which is quite funny when you have a politician coming along who a week ago said, we need more women in politics. And then the next week they ask, what is a woman? And they say, well, I don't want to answer that question.
Right. We need more of them.
Yeah, we just need more of them, whatever they are. Yeah. So that is real. I mean, the thing that worries me, concerns me, is schools. Obviously the school environment here the school system and environment here is very, very different from what you have in the States. But, you know, the vast majority of children go to what we call state schools, what you'd call public schools. And here, they're not like, I mean, there are some really good schools and some not so good ones, but, you know, it's not, you know, schools here are quite different from state schools in the States, and the system is different, but you have that. About 10% go to private schools, most of which are, you know, wealthy fee-paying institutions. Mm. We have very few church schools. Almost all the church schools, well, it's not true. We have a lot of church schools, but the church schools a long time are majority Anglican and then Roman Catholic, and most of them are co-opted into the state system.
Yeah.
So they're what we call voluntary aided. So they get, the church has an involvement in them, but they wear that very lightly by choice. Mm. And the concern is that all sorts of things have been kind of slipped into the curriculum. My youngest son, who's 13, he's in what we call secondary school. So I suppose in the States it would be junior high, and in a big school. And, you know, in the beginning of Pride Month last month, there was, you know, they were just being bombarded all the time by these messages. They had a teacher stand up in front of the whole school saying, look, I'm gay and it's okay to be gay and that sort of thing. You know, and funnily enough, they didn't get anyone standing up saying, hey, I'm heterosexual, you know, and it's okay to be. in the end, it got so to, he actually, he's a brave lad, and he actually challenged it.
Hmm.
And very much to his credit, and much to the school's credit, they sat down with him and listened to him and said, well, tell us what your concerns are.
Hmm.
And made some notes. So we'll see how, you know, whether it will make any difference or not. But there's this sort of, you know, there's this cult, the in your face, loud, we want the law changed now to you know, if people want to identify as dogs, they should be allowed to go into kennels. That kind of stuff isn't happening
right.
So fast here because there's enough pushback. But it's the slow boiling of the frog that concerns me, which is everywhere. And our universities are more being captured more and more as well by, you know, sort of student activism.
The culture too is so is such a big, it has such a big impact. My niece, she is 19 now, something like that. And she was homeschooled her whole life. She was homeschooled in, do you know Thomas Road Baptist Church, Liberty University, Jerry Falwell?
Yeah.
She was homeschooled in Lynchburg, Virginia, by very conservative Christian parents, okay? My brother-in-law and my sister are some of the most conservative, thoughtful, intelligent Christian people I have ever met in my life. They are wonderful people. And they homeschooled this girl her entire life. And she grew up in Jerry Falwell's town in Lynchburg, Virginia. And I mean, that's it. You know, there's no, and still during Pride Month, all about the flags and all of this stuff. When Roe got overturned, was that last week? It feels like it's already been forever with all the screaming. But when Roe got overturned, she has posted on Instagram nonstop about how women need to have access to abortion. And it's just wild to me that, like, I know for a fact your parents don't believe any of this, and I know that you were homeschooled and raised in all this, but the culture still you think this way, you know, just from your friends and the TV. That's wild to me.
But I think this is also why I think it's really very, very important. This is something that's not being very prominent here, because like Roe v. Wade, you know, abortion is just not high on the political agenda here.
Right.
I mean, there are, I mean, I know the number's different, but I mean, this is the UK, I would have thought, has the highest number of abortions per capita in Europe. It's not quite a quarter of a million a year, but it's a lot. But it's just not a big thing. And one of the things, you know, there's a March for Life here every year, you know, even Christians don't notice it. And it's not preached.
Yeah.
It's not something that's taught and preached particularly.
and our church just being equally guilty of it, and myself included, you know, that we just kind of bemoan, you know, it's the same thing. We kind of, you know, quietly say, well, that steak was a bit tough, and don't say anything, you know, and yeah. and it's been something that I've wanted to make a difference more recently, and have, you know, obviously Roe v. Wade was huge news. It's huge news here as well. I mean, yeah. one of the infuriating aspects of British culture is that.
I was going to say you're welcome.
Oh, thanks. Well, it's been a good thing because it's made it a talking point. Because one of the things that a lot of people hear, it's a very frustrating aspect of British culture, is that because the language is the same more or less as in America, people somehow assume that what is true in America must be true here as well. You know, it's when George Floyd dies. We have Black Lives Matter marches here, and the police decide, even though we got lockdowns here and we're not, you know, it's illegal to be gathering outside, the police decide not to police it because politicians say it's too important.
Yeah, well, same here.
Race relations in this country are an entirely different story from the race relations in America. Those two things, I mean, I'm not saying it's all, you know, fun and games and everybody's been happy always, but it's not the same story as. And the same with Roe v. Wade. You know, people start behaving, you know, this is their slippery slope, and now women in Britain are in danger. You know, the Queen has no jurisdiction in America, and the Supreme Court has no jurisdiction in this country. And, you know, you just, you know, sit down and take some deep breath, you'll be fine. But it's been fantastic that it's been all over the news, because it has forced people to show their hand.
Yeah.
And I just really hope, I mean, it's typical that a lot of leaders of prominent churches haven't revealed their hand, even they said nothing about it. You know, they say things about all kinds of other things, but not that. But, you know, it puts it in our minds, so that it doesn't just slip behind the scenes. You know, I think I also listened to the radio yesterday. They were doing some statistical analysis of, it's on the BBC, of some claims and apparently the current best estimate is that one in four women in the United States will have an abortion at some point within their...
kind of high.
Well, in this country, it's a third.
Ooh.
According to best estimates, because the government keeps official statistics. Every single abortion is recorded in government statistics, and they make those data tables available.
Whereas in the States, yours is public as well, right? Like, the only place they could get... and a woman could get an abortion is from a government center.
There are private ones, but as well, but they have to be licensed, of course. And vast majority of the customers in those places are also paid for by the taxpayer.
Right.
Yeah. So it is. So, but it has been. So these sort of things, whether it's abortion or you know, human sexuality, you know, gay rights and so on, and whether it's to do with the gender debates. These things are, you know, they're the sorts of things where I've only really woken up to it recently, properly, is there are things that we mustn't stop talking about. Because the moment we stop talking about them, they become just part of the furniture. Yeah. They just sort of slip into the general atmosphere. And we stop thinking about them. Also, not only that, but we must be very careful about how we talk about them.
Yeah.
You know, to take a non-controversial example, I saw an article this morning, somebody written some, it was from some evangelical publishing place in this country, talking about how boring a lot of modern preaching is. And he said, you know, in order to make preaching more engaging, we mustn't just explain the text, we must proclaim the passage. I said, well, I don't know how you proclaim a passage. I was never taught to proclaim a passage. I was actually taught to, you know, when I was training for the ministry, I was told to proclaim Christ.
Right.
But, you know, the moment you slip into kind of careless use of language, which is why, I mean, this whole thing about pronouns, on the one level, it doesn't matter. You know, because the case that you want to be called Zop, I'll call you Zop, you know, whatever, if he makes you happy, on the one hand. On the other hand, when you do have a he and a she with fixed meanings, so you call him her and her him, you're conceding linguistic ground, and language then trains our minds, and we begin to accept things as normal that before we didn't.
I would also argue against pronouns like on the basis of the eighth commandment.
Yeah, you speak the truth. Yeah, yeah. And there was very, it's very, very interesting. There was a, you know, there was a quite a well-known case of, in this country again, a girl ended up having to be taken out of a quite expensive private school by her parents because she was she spoke up at a school event in a what's referred to euphemistically as a gender-critical point of view, i.e. she was questioning the trans ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And she was bullied so hard by her peers with tacit approval from some teachers. You know, some teachers right. were apologizing to other students for her views that her parents in the end had to take her out for her own, you know, mental and physical well-being. And she was interviewed, I mean, she's underage, but she was interviewed anonymously. And she said, you know, that one of the things that's made her really think hard about this is that she used to suffer from anorexia.
Hmm.
You know, so as an anorexic, she used to look in the mirror, she used to see somebody other than what was actually there.
Right.
And it nearly killed her.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden we are saying that there are all these people saying, you know, I look in the mirror and I see something other than that what is actually there. And we must give them hormones and surgery and change their names and just accept reality. But it's, I mean, it's everywhere. It is absolutely everywhere. And it's been a, I think there was Sweden had a has had a 7,000% increase in girls identifying as boys in the last few years. I mean, it's a typical social contagion. You know, within our group of friends here in this small town, amongst the children of, you know, our peers and children who went to school with my children, there are several cases. And the sample size there is really small, you know, kids from a small elementary school. There are several. And it's a typical case, you know, girl hits puberty, doesn't like it.
Right.
And people say, oh, maybe you're trans. Yeah. You know, and before they say, just wait, you know, you'll get used to it. And how can I help you? And it's that kind of thing. And it's, there are a lot of lives being damaged along the way, often irreversibly.
Yeah, being destroyed.
And so we must, you know, and therefore, you know, it's not just eighth commandment, but the fifth commandment. We must protect vulnerable people and people who are emotionally or in terms of their mental health vulnerable. They are also vulnerable, and it's our duty to protect them, sometimes from themselves. I mean, there's a reason why people try to talk people off the ledges of buildings and bridges.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what business of yours is that? You know, he wants, you know, we're trying to protect people from themselves out of love.
That seems like that seems like the most British take, to see a guy on a bridge and think, oh, we should stop. Oh, what business is it of yours? He wants to jump.
Yeah, yeah.
Let him jump.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you listen to Free Economics Radio, the podcast, but there was a case. I mean, they interviewed somebody several years ago. They just, I can't remember what the topic was even, but they interviewed a taxi driver in San Francisco who'd taken somebody had, you know, called a cab in the middle of the night to Golden Gate Bridge and made it clear that he was going there to jump. And this guy took him there, dropped him off, took his fee, drove home. And when he was interviewed about, well, it's none of my business. Well, he, you know, if he wants to jump, he's not. You know, what's it? What, you know, what, who am I to stop him? Like, whoa!
Wow.
But this is how we are. And this is what's happening with. This is what's happening in wider society. And of course, you know, when we talk about, let's say, you know, take subject a different subject, is, you know, take something like gay marriage. You know, two people love each other. They want to commit to one another and live in all that. You know, what? How does that affect your marriage if they do that?
Right.
And of course, the short answer is it doesn't. You know, my wife and I aren't less happy because two men got married down the road.
Right.
But what it does to marriage and what it does to society to call that marriage and what it does, therefore, to all marriages further down the line, what it does to our grandchildren, what it does to us to say we decide as a society to redefine or to define nature. And call things, you know, things that are in a certain way, and say we are just going to do whatever it takes to ignore nature, and we're going to do something else.
Yeah,
and call that natural. What we are doing is we're undermining the very fabric and foundation of the truth. And of course, you know, this is not a uniquely Christian position. You could make the same case as an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, as Christians, we know this is God's world. It's not just that we oppose these things or we are for these things because God says so in the Bible.
Right.
God doesn't say things in the Bible like kind of randomly, you know, what shall I prohibit today? I know I'm going to prohibit cricket or baseball.
Right.
You know, it's there. It all melts together. God is good. God is love. God is wisdom. God, you know, God is logos, reason, and therefore, you know, when God speaks, he speaks out of his character, and what he says is good and is wise. And sometimes that, you know, our fallen nature rubs against that and it causes us suffering. I mean, I imagine that if you, for example, are exclusively attracted to members of the same sex and you want to be faithful to God's word, that causes you great suffering because it means that you are therefore, you know, you are therefore not going to ever find an opportunity to express your sexual desire with somebody.
Right.
But of course, the moment you say express your sexual desire, you know, okay, we've taken a funny turn somewhere to speak, even to speak like that.
Right.
Because this thing, you know, marriage wasn't given for us to give expression to our sexual desire, but marriage was given for something else.
Have you ever heard of the book Overruled?
No.
I don't know who wrote it. I listened to it on Audible. I'll put a link in the show notes. But it's about the Obergefell decision that legalized gay marriage in the United States. And he talks about how they redefine marriage. And his big point is that, so everyone says that gay people should have the right to marry. And he points out that gay people have absolutely the right to marry just like everyone else. You have the right to find someone of the opposite sex and marry them. Gay people have the same right that straight people do, to marry one person of the opposite sex. But he talks about how they redefine marriage to exactly that, as a marriage is a loving, semi-permanent, emotionally driven commitment to another human being. And that's how they're defining marriage. And he says that that is fundamentally incorrect, that a better definition of marriage is when two opposite but complementary sexed people get together for the purpose of creating and rearing new life. Right? That there's,
yeah,
that marriage is essentially procreative. And that to strip that out is to destroy the institution, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And it's I think it's so, so very, very important to say that. Because again, you know, you think about you know, whose marriage, you know, if you think of, you know, marriage was given before the fall, but who is marriage really important for in a fallen world? And the answer is women and children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the really, really important thing about it, you know. And the moment you stop, you know, it's just like the, you know, the whole trans movement as it currently is, it's, you know, who is it that suffers when we decide to change these things? The answer is women and children.
Yeah. That's, you know, it's another point he brings up in the book. It's a fascinating point. I think his book is off base, because I think if you're going to really talk about the marriage debate, you can't start at gay marriage. You have to start at no fault divorce and kind of work your way from there, because that destroyed marriage before the homosexual lobby ever did. But one of the things he brings up is we're all talking about the rights of two gay people to be in some sort of government recognized union. But nobody's talking about the right of a child to be raised by both a mother and a father.
Mm.
And children have that right. They have the right to be raised by a heterosexual parenting couple, you know, because you need both a mother and a father. Two moms or two dads doesn't cut it. You know, one mom or one dad, and no other parent just doesn't cut it. You need both. And that's not to bash on single parents. There are a lot of amazing single parents that aren't there by choice. But even they, I think, will admit, I think any woman will admit that's a single mom, that boys need their fathers, you know, girls need their fathers, and vice versa.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and, you know, there are some, I mean, again, we're blessed in this country with, we've got a couple of really quite productive and capable church ministers of churches who write on this subject from the position of, you know, there's this gentleman called Ed Shaw. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book, I really love a book called The Plausibility Problem, Church and Same-Sex Attraction. And he's written another book, I think, called You're Not Your Sexuality or something like that. Sam Albury, who I think is based in the States actually, but it is Albrry, Sam Albury. Likewise, and they're both, in their own words, exclusively same-sex attractive. So for them, the idea of having sexual relations with a woman is about as attractive as for a really heterosexual man to have sexual relations with another man.
Right.
It's just impossible. But they also they're both, I think, ordained Anglicans originally. Ed Shaw certainly is Anglican, ordained minister of the church, who believe that the Bible's the word of God and expresses God's goodwill for all. And so they've written from the perspective, why, as, say, if you like, you know, they both of them shun the word gay, because they, you know, there he's got so many connotations of culture, you know, culture and so on, but why it is, you know, as the same-sex attracted, exclusively same-sex attracted man, why we can say that God is good. And that marriage, as he's given it, is the right thing. And why, if necessary, you know, if we need, if life's on celibacy, if necessary, is better than simply following your desires. We have an organization here called Living Out, which is there, exists there to not just to promote this view, but to support Christians in that situation. It's fantastic. If you're you're on Twitter, there's a gentleman on Twitter called Peter Ould, P-O-U-L-D. And again, he's a Church of England priest, evangelical Anglican, and in his own words, he's sort of, his primary sexual attraction is to men, but he's actually married with children, and he's very, and again, speaks very, very, very clearly about this topic, and I think, you know, keeping that there all the time, and I think what we're talking about when we talk about this, you know, are we talking about marriage or are we talking about something else? And I think you're absolutely right, by the way, that, you know, gay marriage is not the issue. It's just the latest rash to have come out of a much deeper disease. Mm-hmm. When gay marriage was being debated here, again, there was I remember listening to an infuriating live debate on BBC Radio, national radio, listened to by, you know, thousands and thousands of people, and they had the, you know, they had a conservative Christian there, and to promote the, or to kind of argue for the traditional position. And his incapacity, his complete inability to define marriage in a coherent way and to say why that would lead us to argue that marriage needs to be between one man and one woman, made it utterly impossible for anyone to even consider a Christian position on this.
Almost like controlled opposition, you know?
But I mean, it's just, but it's not atypical. You know, if we start by saying marriage is about, you know, making kind of permanent living arrangements and forming an exclusive sexual bond with a person whom you love, and then we define love as being very, very fond of and attracted to,
right.
You know, you're going to end up in all sorts of trouble.
Yeah.
You know, so you get there, fell in love, got married, fell out of love, got divorced, for example.
Yeah.
And why shouldn't I marry my motorbike?
Right.
You know, you tell me why I shouldn't.
Yeah.
And if my daughter who's, you know, of age, and I decided that actually there's nobody we love more, etc., you know, why not do it? Or even a stepdaughter, why not do a Woody Allen? And, you know, just, you know, this is it.
Yeah.
And the answer is there is no reason.
You know what? Us four dudes, we really love and care for each other, and we want to be in an exclusive relationship. Why can't the state sanction that? And
we've forgotten what marriage is about. But I think the challenge for Christians, I don't like to use the word challenge, it's much overused, but I think there is a challenge for Christians, which is to make a positive case for all of this, is to argue for the goodness of God's creation, to argue for the coherence of nature, even fallen nature, that, you know, there is such a thing as natural law.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't figure out your way to heaven using natural law. But you can figure out a pretty good blueprint for living a virtuous and flourishing life. I mean, the ancient pagan Greeks managed it. Aristotle managed to write a fairly good textbook on ethics without reference to the Bible. Just accumulated wisdom.
Yeah.
And we are living in the tail end of, I hope, of the 1960s revolutionary spirit. That forget what happened before, we can do better. And new is good, and different is better.
Yeah.
And, you know, I could talk to you for hours about modern music and modern art and architecture and about, you know, the horrendous world we are creating when we fall for the first time ever, we've got the chance to make everybody live in a beautiful place, and we're making everybody live in an ugly place because we choose to. What's happened to us? Whereas, I've just come back from Poland. I was on holiday for a couple of days in Poland in the city of Krakow. Famous, at least for everybody knows it from Schindler's List. Stunningly beautiful place. for the rich. And it was a rich city surrounded by serfs. And the serfs lived in mud huts and in utter penury for centuries and centuries. But their labor built that place. Now we could build places like that for everybody. And what do we do?
It's
that kind of thing. So we've lost, you know, our society, our cultures unanchored itself, not just from God, the creator, but his creation too.
Mm-hmm.
That's, we are two removes, if you like, from the creator, because actually, you know, stuff nature, we're not interested in nature. What do you want to do?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
rebellion, right? Like all the way down.
Mm-hmm. But this is then when the gospel, you know, the gospel comes and it doesn't say, it's not just about pie in the sky when you die.
Right.
So actually, let me introduce you to one who is love. Let me introduce you to the one who made you, and he did it because he is good.
Yeah.
And let me show you what he has in mind for you. And it's not a Cadillac and a swimming pool necessarily, but it is abundant joy.
Yeah.
Because you are loved, embraced, adopted by your Heavenly Father,
mm-hmm.
a good father. You know, if your dad was good, this one's better. If your dad wasn't good, or he was a deadbeat, or he wasn't there, tell you what, this one makes up for that too.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the gospel, and this is where I think Lutherans have to be really careful, so we don't just say it's just about sin and forgiveness. You know, forgiveness of sins is not the goal.
Right.
It's the starting point. And it opens up the whole treasury of God's gifts.
Yeah.
Then if sin is taken away, and there are no barriers remaining, so, well, you know, what could possibly stand in between me and all the goodness of God? I mean, he might make me wait for it. He will make me wait for a lot of it, because that's good for me. And we have to wait for the fulfillment of all things. But my goodness, if God is for me, who can be against me, right?
Yeah.
And that doesn't just talk about enemies, you know, with guns and knives and persecution. He talks about my own nature.
Wow.
My own desires, which are disordered. You know, my disordered desires cannot be against me, because God is for me.
Wow. That's good. Pastor Simeoki, thank you so much.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.